ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A confession. A memory. A lie. What if all three could be wrong? Forensic is a new series from All in the Mind, unpacking the hidden psychology of crime solving. Why innocent people confess? How memories can be rewritten? The science behind true crime. All in the Mind, Forensic. Search for All in the Mind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This week on The Science Show, we head up to far north Queensland again, where science thrives in the tropics.
And ask the question, can insects like house crickets feel pain?
Find out how throwing crumbs to local bird life might change how they evolve.
And why the shrinking Y chromosome and sex chromosomes in general are trouble.
Today's Science Show has some surprising musical associations. It also has strong links with the deep north around Cairns. This song, for instance, arrived last week from Jane Younghusband, all about someone you know.
Sir David Attenborough is always there, on the periphery or in sharp focus. I see him everywhere. Up a mountain in a tree, diving deep down in the sea, he shares his never-ending love of creatures, great and small. Oh, creatures, he loves them all. Sir David Attenborough, our gentle guide, reminding all who listen to stay focused on the things we can't deny. Turtle, whale, orangutan could be made extinct by man. He shares his never-ending love of the creatures, great and small. Oh, the creatures, well, he loves them all. While we're looking blindly at the small,
Science Show listener Jane Younghusband in Cairns with a tribute to David Attenborough. Now 100 plus a few days. And Bill, it's interesting how many scientists are deeply involved in music in various ways.
Hmm.
This week you met Professor Jenny Graves at La Trobe University, and she has composed a whole oratorio, a secular follow-up to Haydn's Creation. And now she has a new book. And news, I hope, about my disappearing Y chromosome.
Robin, I don't know about yours specifically, but yes, the human Y chromosome's a shadow of its former self. And it has been in the news lately. So the International Olympic Committee recently announced that it will test athletes for a gene on the Y chromosome to determine if the athlete can compete in the female category. So I visited Jenny at her berry farm on the outskirts of Melbourne to talk about this test and that new book you mentioned, which she started writing after a brush with death. You've studied sex chromosomes since the 1960s?
Yeah, in one way or another.
And you've published loads of big papers that have changed the way we think about the mammalian genome. You've won a formidably long list of prizes and, of course, appeared on The Science Show quite a few times. One finding, though, you've been quite famous for is this disappearing, dwindling Y chromosome in humans. What was the reaction when you first came out with that calculation?
Oh, that was really funny. I published just a little note in Nature with John Aitken on what happens in sperm, and I just did a back-of-the-envelope calculation, knowing that 166 million years ago, the Y chromosome was the same as the X, and it's degenerated since. So in 166 million years, almost all of its genes, there's only 51 left, so I could easily calculate, well, at this rate, we're going to totally run out of genes on the Y chromosome in 7 or 8 million years. And we published that, And there was a fantastic reaction. People were saying, the end of the human race. You know, what's going to happen when we run out of the Y chromosome? We'll be a race of females. Well, no, that won't work very well because there are about 50 genes that have to come through sperm to be active. And they're really important developmental genes. So we do need sperm and we do need men. So the alternative is, well, maybe we could invent a new sex chromosome. And that's actually happened in some very weird rodents. It's happened twice. You know, maybe that would happen. But it really amused me that people were so alarmed at the thought we might extinct ourselves because of the Y chromosome. And I'm thinking, well, we probably have better ways of extincting ourselves much sooner than that. We really think there are going to be humans around in 8 million years? We've only been human for 200,000 years, so we've got a long ways to go.
So on the Y chromosome, one of those genes is called SRY, and it's been in the news a bit lately because the International Olympic Committee has decided that they will test for this gene to determine if an athlete can compete as female. Yeah. But there are issues with this. Can you just tell me what that SRY gene is first?
Sure. Well, the SRY gene, we know, is the male determining gene. And what it does is activates other genes that eventually produce a testis in the embryo at about 12 weeks after conception. And the testis produces male hormones, and it's the male hormones that make the baby a boy. It's actually a very complicated pathway, and it's full of checks and balances. It turns on a gene called SOX9, but that gene doesn't do anything directly. What it does is it suppresses genes that make an ovary. So you think, why is it so complicated? There's 68 genes that you need to be working, either pushing or pulling or towards a testis to be male. And what that means is that there are people who have variations of some of these genes who may have SRY but are not male because another gene is either more active or less active or pushes too much or pushes too little. And so we know of several variations of sex determination where you get XY females or XX males. Now, these are generally fairly rare, but they do exist. And there's one particularly that seems to be quite common in athletes, and that is babies that are born with a testis that makes androgens, hormones, but the body can't use the androgens because the protein that receives it and activates it in the nucleus, something different about it, so it doesn't bind. So they are girls, they're born girls, they're recognised as girls, but then it turns out that they actually have a Y chromosome and an SRY gene, but they're definitely not male. So the IOC will have to know what the exceptional people are and make allowances for them. Mm. It's not a perfect test, but there is no perfect test.
Now, you have a new book out, and in the very first sentence you say that sex chromosomes are nothing but trouble. And it's a bold way of starting a book called Sex, Genes and Chromosomes. What makes sex chromosomes so troublesome?
Sex chromosomes are very, very weird. I mean, all the other chromosomes, 95% of our genome is present in two copies. And sex chromosomes are present in two copies in females. There's two X chromosomes, but in males have only got one X chromosome. So there's all sorts of very complicated mechanisms to damp down the second X chromosome in females. So X chromosome inactivation is probably the best example of epigenetic silencing of about 1,000 genes.
Okay, so for people with two X chromosomes, one of those X chromosomes is just sitting there not doing anything.
Yes, that's really where I started back in 1963, was looking at X chromosome inactivation, because it seemed like an amazing thing that a whole chromosome is shut off. It turns out that there are genes on it that aren't shut off, and they're probably quite important. The other thing is, of course, men have only got one copy of the X chromosome, and that's got lots of genes on it that do all sorts of other things. It's not a female determining chromosome at all. There are genes that make colour vision pigments and genes that make blood proteins and genes that make enzymes. And so they're really necessary genes. And if something goes wrong, if there's a mutation in one of these genes, and if you're a male, bad luck. you have a disease or you're colorblind. If you're a female, you've got a backup. So having a backup is really good.
Very handy. Now, your book has been more than 30 years in the making or writing. When did you decide to start writing it and why?
I was invited to write a book about 35 or 40 years ago, but I never had time. But then I had a brain bleed, a near fatal brain bleed, and I couldn't see and I couldn't walk, and it was going to be 18 months. And I thought, I'm going to go potty in this 18 months. I can't even watch the Australian Open because I can't see the tennis ball. So I thought, well, I can touch type and I can think. And so I can write this book that I've been hounded about for ages. It was going to be a very thin little book because we didn't actually know very much. It was going to be about the structure of the Y chromosome, the evolution of the Y chromosome, and about X chromosome inactivation, and about how SRY does sex. So it was kind of three little books in one. But unfortunately for the book, I got better. And I had to run the department for some years. So the poor old book got shelved. And by the time I picked it up again, everything had just changed so much. That was the 90s. And we had mainly information from the Human Genome Project with gene mapping information. And I contributed a lot of gene mapping. I moved to Canberra to ANU. And so the book got shelved again. So I rewrote it again for the fourth time, but this time for a more general audience.
What was your recovery like, and did that experience change the way you did science?
It changed the way I thought about life, as it normally would. It surprised me how quickly I came to accept the fact that I might die any minute. I thought it would be really traumatic, but I thought, oh, well, this could be it. And the decisions I had to make, the neurosurgery was very dangerous, and I was warned that, you know, I had 25% chance of death or destruction. I wasn't so scared of death, but the destruction of my brain would have been horrible. And I just felt extremely grateful. I'm very, very determined about getting better. I really worked the physiotherapy all day, every day. I was so determined to get my life back. One of my students came to visit me in hospital and said, well, now you'll be able to figure out what you really want to do. And I thought, yes, what I really want to do is get back to work, get back to my lab, get back to my students, get back to these fascinating things that I'm doing. That's what I really want to do.
Professor Jenny Graves from La Trobe University. That book again is called Sex, Genes and Chromosomes.
Great to hear Jenny Graves again, winner of the Prime Minister's Prize for Science. And as I mentioned, composer of the oratorio Origins, with its marvellous role for Charles Darwin.
I actually asked Jenny if she has another oratorio in her, and she said no, but she has just finished writing a novel. She
really?
Can't be stopped. Yeah, she's great, and we love it.
This is The Science Show on ABC Radio National with me, Robin Williams.
And me, Belinda Smith.
And here is another example of music brilliantly enhancing scientific ideas. E equals MC squared, the musical, once more performed last week at Haberfield School in Sydney and inspired by the remarkable enthusiasm of Indigenous leader from Northern Queensland, Noel Pearson. Noel Pearson, welcome to The Science Show for the first time. Why is it only the first time? I can't believe it. But
thank you, Robin.
Yes, we've talked about you in connection with the first performances of E equals MC squared, the musical.
Yes.
Because I attended the Sydney premiere, opened by Michelle Simmons of physics fame. What made you think of having that musical made in the first place? It seems fairly unlikely in any place.
Robin, I was developing a science curriculum with a team of people from Good to Great Schools, an organisation I founded, and we're based in Cairns. And we decided to bite the bullet and develop a comprehensive primary science curriculum because we sensed a huge demand from teachers and schools to have teaching resources available. Our first aim was to provide these resources for Aboriginal schools that we work with in Cape York Peninsula, and in particular, a school in my hometown of Hopevale. And along with those four well-known strands that the Australian curriculum covers, biology, chemistry, physics, and earth and space science, I wanted an extracurricular activity program that would complement the classroom learning. And so we developed a natural history club for children to collect and report on specimens to the school community every week. We have an Earth and Space Astronomy Club where we get a telescope, a reseller in Cairns to come up and spend a night with the kids and be astounded at the knowledge of our children about what they're seeing in the night sky. So that's our second activity. The third activity is one focused on an element. If you ever go to Hope Vale or Cowan in Central Cape York, you will see a cabinet in the school, a very handsomely built wooden cabinet. It's got all of the elements of the periodic table in it. So these children have this really rich resource that we got these carpenters to build for us with all of the elements of the periodic table. That is our chemistry activity, where we focus on either, in the case of Hope Vale, silica as a mineral that's mined in that community, and we do projects on the economic, social, cultural, and scientific, chemical basis of this focus mineral. So I was then stuck for physics. What do we do with physics? And I remembered reading this book by Badanas, a guy called David Badanas.
Yes, he lives in London.
Right. You know, I was on the beach down in southeast Queensland on 9/11, lazing on the beach reading that book. You know, I love popular history. So I read that back in 2001. And so I had this idea, well, we'll do a musical on the biography of the equation.
Well, that's a leap, isn't it? Very brave.
Now,
may I tell you?
I didn't know who could help us. I actually thought, oh, well, we'll put a pastiche of popular music together and the kids can dance. I was telling my colleague that the first song on my list, uncreative as I am, the first song was Diana Ross's We're in the Middle of a Chain Reaction.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, but that was going to be a pretty thin kind of production. But there was this guy called David Collins White from Sydney, from Haberfield Public School, who was mentoring our music program at the time up in Hope Vale. And I approached David and I said, mate, I want to do a musical on this Badanas book on E equals MC squared, so that I have a physics component to our extracurricular project. And he and a guy called Chris Cohen, who's now the director of the Just Us Theatre Company in Cairns, they put together the lyrics and the music for this musical. And the kids at Hope Vale presented E equals MC squared a couple of months before Haberfield did. And it was a fantastic production.
Yes, it was. And I went to the premiere at Haberfield and I'd interviewed the young people who were on the stage and done rehearsals. And I asked, how do you feel about being Michael Faraday or Emily du Châtelet, you know, a French woman? Because each of these names was connected with a particular part of the equation.
Yes.
And they said they were terribly excited. I said, isn't it too abstract for you? No, no, these are very important people and now we remember them because we're being them.
Yeah.
And it was opened by Michelle Simmons, Australian of the Year and quantum computing fame.
Right.
And there was a standing ovation. It really worked wonderfully. So
yeah.
How did this latest performance in the last few days work?
It was just so great to see these kids from this very multicultural school in Sydney. They're kind of a sister school to our school up in Cape York. They had hosted our music children at the Op when David took them to the Opera House for a music event that all these children were performing at. So this relationship with Haberfield is 5 years old now. And Richard Gill, thankfully, sent David on this mission to mentor our music teachers and students up at our school. So it was just so fortuitous that we had this opera guy in David who would then write this musical for us. And we have it on offer. Instead of doing The Lion King or Oliver, you can do E equals MC squared at your school. If you approach Jules Australia in Cairns, who are on the web, of course.
Yes, Noel Pearson is director of the Cape York Partnership, Good to Great Schools, north of Cairns. So much science going on up there. And yes, 46% of Australia is in the tropics, which is why Susan Lawrence is so busy with international connections, looking after the forests in the north. She's Professor of Tropical Ecology at James Cook University in Cairns. Could you take me to the Daintree and go to the place where you've got this huge crane and whether you actually go up in it?
Yes, we do have a wonderful crane and it makes it one of the most unique rainforests in the Southern Hemisphere. And I do get to go up in it and it's the most glorious experience. And
tell me, what happens?
Oh, can I first tell you that as a rainforest biologist who spent their life in rainforests, we look at the forest always from the bottom and we're missing out on where most of the action is. And so when you get up in the crane and you start to see the rainforest from above, it completely changes your perspective of how that forest is functioning.
And you see the canopy there. And when you look down, what are you actually looking for? What do you see as a scientist?
Well, I think the first thing that I pay attention to is one of that amazing characteristics that makes rainforest more special than any other ecosystem, and it's the diversity of plants. And when you're in the canopy, you're looking for flowering plants and you're looking at how rare they are across the landscape.
How far up in the sky are you?
We're about 40 metres. But the canopy itself may range from 25 to 35 metres. And the beauty of the crane is it can actually drop us down into gaps. So we can reach various tree canopies.
And how long do you stay up there? I'm slightly uneasy with heights, but I'm just wondering if I was invited one day, whether I could dare say yes.
Oh, well, we can do all sorts. We can do just, for the very terrified people, we can just do the elevator movement. Or when we're working up there, we generally can be up there for a couple of hours at a time. Some people get seasick. I've never experienced that. But I think when you're writing a lot of notes and it's moving, perhaps that's why.
For those who don't know this area, how big is the Daintree Forest?
It's quite a hard one to answer because you've got to work out where you're going to cut it off. So the Daintree National Park itself was the largest lowland rainforest national park, and so that was 50,000 hectares. But that's now continuous with parks that go up almost to Cooktown and then south past to Port Douglas.
That's a size, yes.
So it's probably 150,000 hectares.
And what's its health like? Because you're involved with restoration.
Okay, so we've had a long history of deforestation in the region that started with logging in the 1890s, and then that led on to an expansion of agriculture for dairy predominantly and other kind of crops. And that's really focused on the flatlands and on the very good agricultural soils. So we've lost a part of what could have been the most productive part of that ecosystem. North of the Daintree River, there hasn't been a lot of deforestation, but predominantly we're focusing on some in the Daintree, but also in the uplands and lowlands to the south.
And what do you do to restore a forest on that scale?
Ah, well, we've had restoration here for 40 years, and it hasn't been done at scale. And so it's been really targeting critical areas for wildlife corridors. And it's been done with very high diversity plantings and a lot of volunteer effort. But we haven't really attempted to do anything at scale yet.
Bringing the creatures back, which creatures? Cassowaries and so on?
Oh, yes. I think birds are probably the leading movers of seed across the landscape, and so they're the birds, they're the ones that are really attracted by the plantings. So the science behind the restoration is to try to plant trees that fruit very early that are very attracted to frugivores. Because what you might not know is that most rainforest seeds are vertebrate dispersed. They're not wind dispersed. So you need vertebrates to be moving those seeds across the landscape.
Vertebrates including lizards and sailors.
Oh, yes. And I should have answered your question about cassowaries. In Asia and in South America, you might be looking for monkeys predominantly to disperse. Here we've got cassowaries, we've got spectacle flying foxes. And some of the work from CSIRO shows that spectacle flying foxes may move 25 kilometres in a night, so there's a very big opportunity for them to move seeds around the landscape.
So what have you done so far? What plantings and so on?
30 years ago, I had my dream job of being a park ranger, and I got involved then in planting the first wildlife corridors in rainforest in Australia. And then I've gone off, done other things, come back, and now I'm more involved now in identifying key areas and trying to work out how we can keep forest regenerating into something very successful as an ecosystem. So right now, we plant from grass to forest, and it looks great and it makes a big difference. But long term, if we really want it to replicate a rainforest, then we may need other interventions at different periods.
Yeah, I can imagine. The smaller things you don't notice particularly. The fungi, the way you restore earth.
Yes, fungi and insects, I think, are really important. We focus so much on the trees growing up, but we're not really focusing on what's happening underneath. And a lot of the carbon that's going down is really just in roots and leaves that are falling, but there's no timber. And we need that timber to be recycling down in the soils to build up the soils and to build up the resilience of the ecosystem. So, yes, I'm very interested in insects, termites of all things now. I've got a student working on termites. And fungi, I would love to work more on fungi, but it's kind of a bit of a tough nut to crack.
Yeah. Have you heard of the experiment involving young people, say primary school kids, in the Miyawaki forests, which are being pioneered in Murdoch University in Perth? And they go to various areas, which are sort of abandoned car parks or whatever, taught how to restore the earth as well. I don't know about termites, but they're taught the complexity of what's down there in what's called dirt, and no longer dirt, it's soil. And they can watch on the restored landscape, the size of a tennis court or more, how the planted saplings grow so much better. And they can see after 1 or 2 years, bingo, they've done it. And so they're really excited by that. And young people aren't supposed to be excited by anything that takes any long-term application.
Well, we have Miyawaki here as well in North Queensland, not so much with the schools that I know about, but it is a very fascinating approach to how to do restoration, and it's really focused on the below ground, developing that below ground. And one of the things that we notice with restoration is that not all sites restore at the same rate. There's always that legacy of past land use, which can affect how forests recover. And I think the Miyawaki focus on below ground is a really important idea in how we can focus on the below ground in making sure that the plants have those resources to grow well.
Now, you said you went away for a bit, and of course you went away to a place like the Amazon. How much did that experience of those completely, I would imagine, different forests influence what you're doing here?
The Amazon's amazing place to be working. Everywhere you look, there's undiscovered things and lots to do. But it does also give you a perspective of how important in Australia, because we have so little forest, so how important it is, because it supports so much of our biodiversity terrestrially in the country, and it's extremely important for us both as an ecosystem but to our community. So I think it's given me perspective that we have to protect what's special here, because Australia was once like the Amazon. We were once covered by rainforests, the size of the Amazon today, and we now only have these very small tracts remaining that are really precious.
I remember further south they were protecting what they called the remnants of the Gondwanan rainforest, somewhere in northern New South Wales, for example, near the rivers. Is the same sort of thing to be applied to where we are now, in just beyond Cairns? Is that Gondwanan remnant?
A lot of our rainforest is Gondwanan, particularly the uplands. That, and we have, in fact, some of the oldest lineages, Gondwanan lineages, in our forest, which is partly why they consider the Australian wet tropics the oldest rainforest in the world, because of those old lineages, the abundance of those old plant families. But we also have Asian plants that have arrived over millennia, but they're predominantly in the lowlands. So it's kind of our upland mountains which are the remnants of our Gondwanan history.
What do you think the rest of Australia needs to know, more than the name of the Daintree, for example, about this sort of heritage you've just described?
That it's ancient, that it's been here on this continent for millions of years, but it may not always be here in the future.
Unless you save it with your friends.
Oh, yes. Well, I think it's going to take more than that. I think we need to be really aware, just phenomenal for me, that something can last for so long, but now be at such a risk with climate change. And that just having an understanding of that vulnerability, I think, is important to know.
Susan Lawrence, Professor of Tropical Ecology, in touch with the world from Northern Queensland.
And of course, one of the soundtracks of Northern Australia is that beautiful symphony of insects, and crickets in particular are known for their songs. But research has emerged over the past couple of decades that suggests that crickets can also feel pain. Tom White is an entomologist at the University of Sydney, and he's just had a study out about this. A cricket that we might see jumping around the house, how do you tell if that can experience pain? What sort of tests do you do?
We test it with some difficulty, because we can't, of course, just ask these animals.
Sure.
We can ask one another. From our perspective, behaviour is really the kind of best tool we have to get at the inside from the outside. We are dealing with animals here that are so different from us that looking at the kind of brains that we use to feel things, it's not so useful as a guide to what an insect might feel. So we instead turn to behaviour, and there are a lot of discussion in sort of the science and philosophy of these things as to what kind of behaviours might be indicative of something going on the inside. We see our beautiful companion animals maybe licking a paw or limping. We can look for these same indicators in other animals, and that's exactly what we sort of went looking for in our crickets here.
So what did you do to these crickets?
One of the tensions and the unfortunate tensions of these research is that we go looking for pain, so we do kind of intend to make them a bit uncomfortable.
Mm.
So in this case, it was kind of similar to a person touching a hot pan, for example, and they touch it. There's that reflex, that initial very quick action where a nerve signal shoots to your spine, whips your hand away, and then comes the actual pain and you feel it. And the person will, you know, you'll nurse your hand and run it underwater and look after it. So we put our crickets through something similar. We used a little hot probe and we touched it on their antennae, and we made sure, we did some work beforehand to make sure that it was warm, so it was hot, meant to make them uncomfortable but didn't cause any lasting damage or injury. So we touched them, and then we had our control groups where we didn't touch them or we just gave them a little poke, and we watched the kind of behaviours that resulted. And what we found is, again, just like that person that, you know, you hold your hand and look after it, or your cat or dog licking their paw, attending to it, we found that crickets focused all their attention on that antennae. So they groomed it. They held it with their hands. They brought it to their mouth. They nibbled on it. And they did so much more frequently than either of our other groups. And they focused on that antennae that was touched. And they did so for a long time as well.
How long would they do it for?
We popped the probe on, and that was maybe 5 seconds. And then the crickets themselves would tend to these things for, we watched them for 10 minutes. And after about 4 or 5 minutes, then they were back to sort of baseline.
Oh, okay, rightio. Okay, so it's kind of like, I don't know, imagine smacking your funny bone and you kind of go, oh, and you hold your arm to
and
your
rub
body.
It and, oh, yep. That's really annoying. That hurts, but like, I'm okay. It's, you know, we can get over it. I'm just frustrated. So that was the level of discomfort that we were trying to introduce to our crickets. And that's pretty well what we saw, we think. And what that tells us is that these are very unlikely to be kind of hardwired, robotic sort of reflexes, the kinds of things that for a long time we thought that's all that insects were really capable of. And so instead, that starts to suggest that there's something more going on. And we think it's reasonable at this stage and to think that that something more might be feeling.
Why crickets?
I think there are two broad reasons. Crickets are an excellent system for this kind of question. One is that crickets are a very old group of insects. They're members of an evolutionarily ancient group, so they arose quite early in the tree of life. So if we do find cool, interesting capacities in these insects, it suggests that similar abilities might be also present in all of the other millions of species of insect that we see today. The other reason is because crickets are kind of like the cow or the pig of the insect world. So they are heavily domesticated the world over, and we rear them, we farm them in their hundreds of millions, and that's projected to grow very, very rapidly into the future. We use them for things like aquaculture, so feeding to fish, and as alternate sources of protein. So it makes sense as a bit of a priority that we'd like to know if they do have welfare interests, if their lives can go better or worse for them, because we're interacting with them at a massive scale.
But the crickets that you used in your study, what happened to them after the tests were done and finished?
Yeah. So we are mostly a behavior lab. So we work with these whole animals and we ask them all sorts of questions and watch them behave. So these particular crickets, once they did the kindness to participate in our experiments, they just lived out the rest of their lives for a month or two, had all the food and water they wanted, had access to their buddies if they needed it in our cages in the lab, and they lived out the course of their natural lives. And that's something we've actually always done, because I can't do it unless it's absolutely necessary. I just find it too hard to euthanize insects.
What about a mosquito in your bedroom at nighttime?
There are always exceptions. For me, in the invertebrate world, I do struggle a bit with leeches. I find them, I love all living things and I love all invertebrates, but leeches do kind of give me the willies. So I admit they stretch my intuitions.
Tom White from the University of Sydney, showing that even entomologists can get the heebie-jeebies from creepy crawlies. And down the track, we'll take a look at what this kind of pain research means for insects and us.
Yes, Bill, recognising pain in such creatures is a challenge, but one consolation is that they reproduce quickly and numbers are large, so you can experiment and see effects. But now moving to larger creatures, especially birds, Pamela Yeh from the University of California, Los Angeles, has found with little sparrow types that you can actually see change on the university campus quite quickly, meaning that it's like that in every town and farm, if only you looked, such as with juncos.
So a junco is a small, unstreaked sparrow, and the name comes from its genus name, which is junco. But they're very, very cute. They're very common in the U.S. And of course, now they've started to colonize urban areas, more of us are seeing them. The subspecies that we have has a ground gray back and wings and a white belly, and they're very fluffy and very cute. And they're also called the snowbird because you'll see them popping around in the snow.
Yeah, and because they're really cute, people do what I do, and that's feed them.
Yes, yes, they're great at the feeders. If you have a feeder and it's hanging, what you'll often see are other birds perched on the feeder, and then the juncos will eat the birdseed that has been kicked off or fallen off or blown off. So you'll see a lot of juncos on the ground popping around. They're just adorable.
And is this a case of the more they interact with people who have food, so in fact something about those birds changes, evolves, adapts? What's happened?
Yes. Well, on the campus of UCLA, we have tons of people, undergraduates, it's lots of faculty and staff. Of course, we have the whole medical school area, so we also have patients, and everybody needs to eat. And so, as you can imagine, we have a lot of food availability. And you often see juncos, instead of on the grasses, you often see them hopping around any place where there are people and food, them crumbs left over along the trash cans, just even hang out by the tables, waiting for people to leave, and they will grab something. So we think that the food resources are very, very different between the cities and their natural environments up in the mountains, you know, montane, forested, meadowed areas. And as a result of having different sources of food, we think that that is affecting the types of beaks that these juncos have. the ones that are able to get all the human food can end up doing really well. And when there isn't, like during the pandemic, when suddenly everything closed and closed for a very long time, it was for two breeding seasons for us. The types of foods that became available to the birds changed. And you see a lot more of the birds eating seeds and insects.
Back to nature for them rather than people.
Yes, exactly. And so we were really shocked. We weren't really looking for this, but we were really shocked when we were looking at the changes in beak shape and size over time. We saw that during these years when we didn't have people, when the campus was essentially closed and classes were all online, we saw a very different set of beak traits.
Well, I seem to remember there was a young man aged about 23 called Charles, who went to somewhere off the coast of South America, Galapagos, was it, perhaps, where there are lots of islands. And on each island was a different sort of food. And guess what? Yes. Beaks were different there as well.
Yes, I think he did a lot of work on mockingbirds, actually, and found this incredible variation in the form and function of a lot of these traits.
And so how are you following that up now here on campus to see how quickly, because that's an awfully short time for adaptation to take place on a discernible way.
Yes, it is. And actually, it's interesting that you talk about the Galapagos and Darwin, and, you know, he has all these finches named after him, the Darwin's finches, and they are a bunch of birds that are very closely related. They look actually very similar, except for their beak. There's this huge variation in beak size and shape. And speaking about rapid evolution, the Grants, Peter and Rosemary Grant, and their lab in the 70s continued to work on these islands, and they found extremely rapid evolution based on the environment. There was a huge drought in the 70s, and most of the plants had died off, the seeds had died off, but there were still like these really hard, larger seeds left. And the birds that had bigger beaks that were stronger, they could break open these seeds because there's no other food left, were able to survive at a much higher rate.
And reproduce.
And reproduce, exactly. Survive to be able to stay and reproduce the following year, exactly. And they found this in 1 year. And the cool part was, well, that part was already cool. So they found a huge change. From 1 year to the next, the bird beaks got a lot bigger because of this drought. And then, though, there was a huge rainfall. And what you saw was a move back, and it was actually very similar. So what we're doing in some ways has been seen before, but it was just really strange because it was the pandemic causing this change rather than these natural variations in weather. It was human, not even the pandemic, it was a human response to the pandemic, that we closed everything and suddenly there were no people and we weren't eating outside. How rapid changes happen, we have seen that before.
And you have seen it before, and it's very interesting. But also the other aspect of what you're talking about is having people, ordinary people, looking around their parks, their campuses, and their gardens.
Yes.
You can see amazing stuff.
Yes, absolutely. You know, when I think about this research that we did, that's one of the biggest takeaways that I really want people to get, is that if we look, we can find amazing things. I think evolution has to be going around, and all these really interesting evolutionary effects like strong selection pressures or has to be happening right before our eyes, but we just have to look and we have to keep our eyes open because there's always something going on. I think that's one of the biggest takeaways. This is happening right on the campus of our local university, UCLA. It's right in many people's backyards. But even if we literally looked in our own backyards, this is what's going on. And there's probably so much more that we're missing. I think that's such an important takeaway.
With more and more animals coming into town, we've got bin chickens, as they're called, the ibises, which are large birds, and they raid the bins. And of course, we've got the white cockatoos, which know how to open wheelie bins, and they copy each other and learn from each other. Adaptation.
Yes, exactly. Those are strong selection pressures in terms of having a really big effect on the environment. And so we really should try to understand, how are we affecting populations? How are we affecting biodiversity of the whole ecosystem?
And you can tell that by taking your knowledge and going from the cities out into the wild and doing a comparison, like Darwin did.
Exactly. How are they behaving and how do they look and what's their morphology in the wild and how can we compare that to what they're doing in the cities?
Pamela Yeh, Professor of Evolutionary Biology at University of California, Los Angeles. And so back to Cairns, northern Queensland, and another reminder of the essential ability, knowing how to look at something and see a pattern or structure that most might miss. Here's a leading archaeologist at James Cook University.
Ariana Lambridis, Greek. My dad is Greek and my mum is Scottish, but my name is principally Greek.
Well, Scottish is almost Greek, isn't it?
They might agree to disagree on that one.
One problem, Ariana, and I found this when I was looking down a microscope, supposing to see what other people saw in that kind of haze or blob of something, whatever it is. I could never differentiate, and they could do so almost immediately. Now, I find the same sort of thing when I look at samples. Your wonderful rooms here are full of drawers of samples of parts of fish. Now, I can't tell one from the other, but then you've got to add another difficulty of trying to work out whether it's got ancient human associations. When you are just walking around on a coastline or somewhere like that, how do you actually differentiate between what's important and what isn't?
Well, for us as archaeologists, we're interested in people's relationships with those fish. So we're looking at ancient campsites, middens. These are accumulations of shell and bone and stone. And these are places that people return to over thousands of years. So this is the kinds of signatures that we're looking for to give us that really rich record of people's interactions with fish. While I do like walking along the beach and collecting shells that roll in from the waves, we're not necessarily going there, though of course you can recover archaeological remains from submerged archaeological sites, and that's a whole other story, but we're looking for very specific contexts to be able to find these remains.
Where recently have you been walking to look?
Principally, I am working with traditional owner communities from the Great Barrier Reef. So working on Yiguru or Lizard Island most recently to look at their amazing cultural places, and we've done lots of excavations on campsites and surveyed across many kilometres of their incredible country to document all of the wonderful cultural places associated with that island group. And another sort of big aspect of what I do too is look at museum collections. So there's a lot of work that's been done in Queensland, for example, over many decades, and techniques have moved forward. So we can actually go back without doing new excavations and do renewed analyses on those existing collections. So that's a big focus as well of the work that I do, is not just going out and doing new excavations, but working together as partners, thinking about what new research questions that we can investigate using these collections that have been, you know, just sitting in a museum for 2-3 decades. What can we do with them now?
Dr. Ariana Lambridis, archaeologist in Cairns, and we'll hear her full amazing story in a couple of weeks, doing detective work on tiny clues. Another report coming up, searching for the tiniest of clues for a gigantic payoff scientifically. It's our old friend Dark Matter. Dan Falk in Canada reports.
If you drive north from Toronto for a couple of hours and then keep on driving, you eventually get to the small city of Sudbury, Ontario. Now, every city has its attractions. Sydney has the Opera House and the Harbour Bridge. London has the Houses of Parliament. And Sudbury, well, Sudbury has the Big Nickel.
Oh, up there, I see it. All right, nickel. Now I'm happy.
That other voice is American science writer George Musser. We drove up here together.
I thought it was going to be 5 or 6 meters across. I think it's almost 10 meters across.
It is way bigger than we thought. This is enormous.
The Big Nickel is the world's largest coin, a gigantic 5-cent piece. In Canada and the US, they're called nickels. Now, a giant coin may seem pretty random, but there's actually a logical, historical reason why it's here. The Big Nickel honors the nickel coin, but it also celebrates the element nickel, number 28 on the periodic table, the metal that most Canadian coins used to be made from. There's a lot of nickel beneath the ground here in Sudbury, and they've been mining it for more than 120 years. But the Creighton Mine, located just outside the city, is special, because along with the actual mining operation, there's also a unique scientific laboratory located inside the mine, deep below ground. Having rested up after our Big Nickel adventure, we're up early the next morning to make our way to the Creighton Mine.
It's about 5 a.m. and still pitch dark out, so we're a little bit lost.
This is the right place.
I hope so.
We're on the lookout for our guide, Juliette Deloy.
Yes, there she is.
When I visited here the first time, back in the late 1990s, the laboratory was called the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory, or SNOW. In the early 2000s, the lab expanded and was rebranded as SNOW Lab. Juliette Deloy is SNOW Lab's Education and Outreach Coordinator.
Good morning.
Hello.
George and Dan.
How do
That's
you know?
Right.
Awesome. Tap these and tap that one, and
okay.
It'll flash green, you'll come through.
Thank you.
Aside from being our tour guide, Deloy is working on her master's degree at Laurentian University, and she seems to know everything there is to know about this laboratory and its unique setting.
We're looking at the Creighton Mine Shaft Number 9 mining site. This is essentially where the cables for the elevator that will take us underground travel through.
Remind me how long the mine has been here.
So Creighton Mine's been around for just around 100 years now. There's a couple different components to Creighton Mine. There's an open pit mine that isn't really in use anymore, but there's also the underground mine where we are today.
Taking advantage of the mine shaft and underground tunnels that had already been here for decades, scientists set their sights on the mine in the 1990s and built the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory. All you need to know for now is that neutrinos are elusive subatomic particles that have almost no mass and hardly interact with other types of matter. Work on neutrinos carried out at SNOW would eventually garner a Nobel Prize.
I'm Ray Bunker. I'm the director of research at SNOW Lab.
At SNOW Lab, Bunker and his colleagues are probing the mysteries of the cosmos, from the Big Bang to the nature of dark matter. And as weird as it may seem, even though they're studying, well, the universe, the best place to do it is from deep below ground.
What is unique about SNOW Lab is its combination of depth and cleanliness. It is the deepest, cleanest laboratory in the world for conducting underground science of the various types that we pursue.
Now, getting down into the mine is a whole big production. SNOW Lab is located some 2 kilometers below ground, and this is a working mine, so the first order of business is to change out of our street clothes and into industrial mining gear.
So that's us, so make sure we have all our PPE on, make sure our safety glasses are on.
Okay.
And as for actually getting to the level of the laboratory, well, there's only one way down. We ride down in a 5-foot by 12-foot elevator that they call the cage. You could almost squeeze a Volkswagen Beetle into it if the cage wasn't already full of mine workers.
Dan Fork in Canada, and the full story soon in The Science Show.
Next week, artificial intelligence in the oceans. Oh gosh, is nothing safe from AI?
No. But the aim of this AI is to do good, tracking sharks, restoring ecosystems, maybe even translating whale language, would you believe?
Fascinating. Maybe we'll be doing the Science Show in whale down the track.
It's a challenge.
Well, the Science Show is produced by David Fisher. I'm Belinda Smith.
And I'm Robin Williams.
At the smaller picture, we can't see the forest or the trees. He's a closing in on the specific issue, quietly insisting that we seize this chance to care. We gotta care. Treasure this earth. Gotta do our share. So David Attenborough will live forever. Still with a twinkle shining in his eye, I believe he'll never die. In the corner of my mind, I will always see his smile and share in his never-ending love of the creatures, great and small. Oh, creatures, gotta love them. David loves them all. is always there. Sir David Attenborough is always there.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.